We'll move to the next case of the morning, which is United States versus Lewis. Okay, Mr. Giesen.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Charles Giesen. I'm representing Patricia Lewis, who was convicted following her plea of guilty to attempted possession with intent to distribute 9 ounces or 252 grams of cocaine. She received a sentence at the very top of the advisory guidelines of 87 months, and she appeals the reasonableness of that sentence. At the time of the offense of conviction on February 20, 2003, Ms. Lewis was a hardworking, law-abiding, devoted single mother. She'd had a troubled history as a child, having been abused by her parents and her boyfriends. She didn't complete high school. She suffered from mental and emotional problems and required psychiatric care for those problems. Ultimately, in 1999, she began using crack cocaine and quickly became addicted to that, and for the next 2.5 years or so was involved in buying and selling crack cocaine. But in April or May of 2002, she hit rock bottom. She lost a job that she'd held for 6 years. Her son was arrested for a cocaine offense, and she blamed herself for that. She felt terribly guilty. She vowed to quit all involvement in cocaine, and she did so. For the balance of the year 2002 and into 2003, she neither used, bought, nor sold any cocaine. Until early in 2003, at the instigation of a government informant seeking leniency for his crimes, she again mistakenly did agree to buy cocaine, which was the offense of her conviction. The district court incorrectly calculated Ms. Lewis' guidelines and erred in finding that this was a part of the same course of conduct as the previous dealings in years past that she had quit. This was not part of the same course of conduct for several reasons that this court has noted on many occasions. It involved different persons. She'd never before in her life dealt with the informant Kranig. It involved a different modus operandi. Most of the previous transactions had been done on a front. This was a cash transaction. It was done at a different location. Previously, she had customarily dealt out of her home. This was at a motel the informant had rented. It was separated in time. During the interval after she quit, there was no significant regularity, as there had been in the past when she was.
So now she's involving a lot more people.
Well, the important point is there was no regularity. She did become involved again with one informant.
Because they had information to go after her, and that's why they went after her.
That was never articulated. There's no credible evidence whatsoever anywhere in the record that Ms. Lewis was involved in dealing during
that.
Well,
how did they get the informant? Because she wasn't dealing?
Well, she had been in the past.
And he knew that was going on now, and to cover himself, he gave information.
But that informant, Stephen Kranig, never said that Ms. Lewis was currently involved. The only common element was that it involved the same drug. And as this court has noted on many occasions, the fact that it is a drug transaction or involves the same drug is not enough to establish that this is the same course of conduct.
Help me out here, because I have searched the PSR, I have searched the sentencing memorandum, and I, without reading the entire record, which eventually one of us will have to do, did the district court ever find that Lewis and Viscar, her son-in-law, were in a conspiracy to sell cocaine? I'm going to ask you the same question.
The district court did not make the explicit finding of a conspiracy. I guess, in essence, it did when it found that they were involved in the business together or were partners. And again, that's another reason why this would not
be. But is there an explicit finding, which we have to have in this circuit, that they were in a conspiracy?
Not using the term conspiracy. No such explicit finding.
So what was the basis for attributing Viscar's sales to Ms. Lewis?
In spite of the fact that there was sworn evidence from Viscar and Ms. Lewis by way of affidavit, the only basis was the judge's blanket adoption of some informant statements that they dealt cocaine together. And while that may be true, that may have been in a buyer-seller relationship, there was not an explicit finding of a conspiracy.
Okay.
And therefore, it was unreasonable to attribute Viscar's cocaine to Ms. Lewis. Ms. Lewis, at sentencing and prior to sentencing in her sentencing memorandum, also brought to the district court's attention several mitigating factors, such as her age, her troubled childhood, her mental and emotional conditions, her drug addiction, her stellar employment record, and her role in the offense. The district court ignored all of those mitigating factors, with the exception of its discussion of role in the offense, which was an imperfect entrapment issue, which the court denied. But with respect to all the other mitigating factors that the district court is now required to consider under Booker and under 3553A, the judge simply did not articulate any consideration of those. There was a passing reference to having read all the documents in the file at the beginning of the sentence, but there was no real true consideration or anything that would indicate any deliberation or weighing of those mitigating factors. As this court recently held in Dean, the courts must consider the factors listed and cannot import their own philosophy and impose a sentence inconsistent with those factors. Dean also goes on to require, in certain circumstances, explicit fact-finding if the facts are material to the sentencing decision. And in Dean, the sentencing factor was the defendant's mental or emotional state, which was certainly present here and which was well substantiated by Dr. Hurlbut's psychological evaluation. So it can't be said that these mitigating factors are not material to the sentencing decision, and especially because 3553A now trumps the guidelines. In our view, when the defendant brings those factors to the judge's attention, the judge cannot simply ignore them, as was done in this case. This reviewing court, which has an obligation now to review the reasonableness of sentences, has no way to know if the court failed to consider them, which would be an inappropriate sentence, or if the district court considered and ignored them, which would also be a violation of the mandate of Booker and 3553A. Dean, in our view, requires an adequate statement of the reasons. There was no such statement given in this case. I'll reserve the balance. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Ms. Altman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the government in this case. As the defendant has argued, he believes that the sentence the defendant received was unreasonable. In determining whether or not this is true, the Court should first decide whether the advisory guideline range of 70 to 87 months was correctly calculated. Because if so, her sentence is presumptively reasonable since it was within that range. After the court considers the calculation of the guideline range, it should then consider whether there are any 3553A factors which would rebut that presumption of reasonableness. No. The defendant made several challenges to the guideline calculation in his brief. The first one.
I think that the first question that really needs to be answered is where in this record will we find that Ms. Lewis and Mr. Vizgar were in a conspiracy?
Your Honor, the district court judge specifically adopted paragraphs 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21 through 26 of the PSR.
Correct. As the district court stated, the court, as previously stated, adopts paragraph 17. I'm looking at Christopher O'Day and Robert Morey, indicating they purchased at least 1738 ounces and 52 ounces of cocaine from Patricia Lewis and or Claire Vizgar, Lewis's son-in-law. And that's what he said throughout, and or. So where will I find that we can attribute? What is the basis for attributing Vizgar's sales to Lewis, absent an explicit finding that there was a conspiracy? How can I do that?
Well, in paragraph 18, there's witness testimony that he stated, this is talking about Cliff Riddle. He stated he knew that because of Claire Vizgar's involvement with Cliff Riddle, the majority of the drugs were going to Lewis. Wiedemann said that every time he dealt with Lewis, Cliff Riddle or Claire Vizgar was present. He also said Vizgar and Lewis were business partners. That's a paragraph that was specifically adopted by the district court.
But how much cocaine? What was reasonably foreseeable to Lewis? Was it a buyer-seller relationship? Where is the explicit? We have to have an explicit finding of conspiracy.
Well, to find all of the amounts, Your Honor, specifically, Robert Morey indicates that he was involved with purchasing cocaine from Lewis from just before winter of 2000 through the next 2 years. So that amount doesn't have anything to do with Claire Vizgar at all.
What is that amount? What was that amount?
The amount attributed to Mr. Morey was 52 ounces of cocaine. The other amount that she was sentenced on was the amount attributed to Mr. O'Day, who indicated that he had bought an 8-ball each day for 139 days straight from Vizgar and Lewis.
Vizgar
and or Lewis.
Forget it. You know better than that. So
the judge did adopt those findings, Your Honor, where everyone had said that they were in business together.
And or. That would be a brand new way, you know, to find a conspiracy between two people. That's some kind of a situation between three people.
The district court specifically disregarded their statements that they had nothing to do with each other. They both submitted affidavits as such and believed that they were making the findings in the PSR that they were in business together. But as I did note, the testimony from Mr. Morey was that he did specifically purchase the 52 ounces of cocaine directly from Ms. Lewis. The court found that Mr. Morey's testimony was credible. He found that Mr. O'Day's testimony was credible. He specifically addressed the witness credibility, and by not only adopting the PSR, but also by making a specific finding on the record that the witnesses were believable and credible. And he specifically found the defendant to be incredible when he was assessing the imperfect entrapment defense.
The court believes that paragraph 18, which is the one that you argue is the one that we should set our sights on, the court believes that paragraph 18 sets forth a substantial amount of additional cocaine, which had been sold and traded, as well as 19, except there's no source to demonstrate the amount which was sold to either Vizgar or Lewis. Can't accept that amount. There's no factual basis for determining the amounts in 18 or 19.
Your Honor, in the paragraphs, I believe he was referring to amounts sold by Chad Wiedemann, sold by Cliff Riddle, sold by Jason Addington. All of those amounts he did not include in the calculation because he did not believe that those people were corroborated amongst themselves.
Then why were you arguing that we should take a close look at paragraph 18? I'm having a problem.
He didn't discard the whole paragraph. He discarded the amounts that were attributed to these people in 18. And I believe that there's other things in the PSR that indicate that they dealt drugs together. According to O'Day and Maury, in paragraph...
They very well were probably dealing drugs together. Well, again, I say to you, we have to have a basis for attributing Viscar sales to Lewis, and that's what seems to be missing.
Well, it also talks in paragraph 17, which the court specifically adopted, according to statements provided by Christopher O'Day and Robert Maury, whom the court specifically found to be credible and reliable, indicate that they purchased 17.38 and 52 ounces from them.
Read it.
Respectively,
of cocaine from
Patricia Lewis and or Claire Viscar,
okay,
Lewis's son-in-law. According to O'Day and Maury, corroborated by statements from other individuals, Viscar and Lewis were in the cocaine business together.
I'm not making my point.
I understand your point. I believe I just disagree with it. I believe that the finding that the court made was sufficient to find that these two were in business together and that she should be held responsible for the amount attributed by Mr. O'Day as well. For sure the amount attributed by Mr. Maury, because he specifically says that he purchased the drugs from her. He does not say and or Mr. Viscar. He specifically says the drugs from Ms. Lewis. And he says that he purchased them from just before the winter of 2000 through the next 2 years.
That was 1,470 grams. So when we add up the 272 that was on her person and the 1470 that for Maury, that totals 1,742 grams. The cutoff for the next offense level is 2,000 grams. So we need to find her accountable for more than 258 additional grams. And that's where the problem lies.
I understand your concern, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I do believe that she was involved in a continuous course of conduct. I think the evidence shows that. I believe from the record the court can find they were in business together, as the district court did. I think, therefore, the sentencing guideline range was correctly calculated, including the criminal history points, since the district court did find that the relevant conduct dated back to 1998. And, therefore, I believe the guideline range was properly calculated. As far as the mitigating factors, they were all made known to the district court through the PSR, through the defendant's objections to the PSR, through the sentencing memorandum, all of which the court acknowledged reading prior to imposing sentence. Additionally, these mitigating factors were orally argued at sentence. The court did not address them all. He's not required to address them all, but he did specifically address the mitigating claim of imperfect entrapment and dismissed that claim, considered all of the evidence that was before him, and believed that the sentence of 87 months to be a reasonable sentence in conformity with 3553A, and I would respectfully request this sentence affirm that sentence, this court affirm that sentence.
Thank you. Mr. Giesen? Got a minute and a half.
This court has stated in the past, as have other courts, that the guidelines had been the tail that wags the dog. It's apparent that even post-Booker, that's still the case, and that's why this court is a reviewing court with respect to the reasonableness of guidelines and their application and the propriety of their calculation has to apply heightened scrutiny. I had searched the record for many of the specific findings. The problem is they are simply not there. There's a blanket adoption of paragraphs which in and of themselves contain internal inconsistencies and contradictions. So this court or any reviewing court looking at a record such as this would have no opportunity whatsoever to know what the basis of the decision was or why a particular witness whose testimony was unsworn and contradicted itself should be given credence over sworn testimony. For those reasons, we would respectfully request that the court determine that Ms. Lewis' prior dealings before she quit were not part of a common scheme or plan, and that the guidelines were improperly calculated, and we would ask that this court remand this matter for resentencing consistent with that determination and with due regard to be articulated on the record by the district court for the mitigating factors Ms. Lewis presents. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch. Both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.